Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, July 25th, 2025. I'm Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on the show, we're resharing an interview from 2023 featuring Scott Martin and Sean Smuckler. Sean Smuckler is an associate professor in applied biology and soil science at University of British Columbia, UBC, and director of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at UBC Farm. Martin and Smuckler discuss the current challenges farmers are facing in Canada due to climate change and wonder aloud where Canada is headed. Here are Martin and Smuckler in conversation. Take a listen.
Well, I want to thank you, Professor Smuckler, for taking the time to speak with us today. So I guess my first question is, a lot of Canadians who are east of Manitoba may not be aware of the agricultural situation that's going on out west. So can you briefly describe what the situation has been like over the past few years?
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster ride for BC farmers. The last few years have been, people use the word unprecedented quite commonly these days. But in fact, BC farmers, I think, are really exemplifying what that means. We're seeing floods, fires, droughts, heat domes. And these are all things that have long been predicted by scientists to be outcomes of a warming climate. And they're all happening quite rapidly here and now. And our farmers are reeling from 3 years of this quite astonishing climate pattern.
So when you say farmers are reeling from this situation, what has been, at least to your knowledge, like the impact on crops, on livestock, to farmers that has been so devastating?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty commodity dependent. So, the British Columbia is an incredibly diverse agricultural system. We've got over 200 commodities being produced in very different climatic regions on different soil types. And the impacts of the weather patterns that we've been seeing are very diverse and regionally specific and crop specific. So, for example, we had a flood that impacted producers in the southwest region of the province. And that was quite devastating for perennial crop growers like blueberry producers or for the dairy producers in that region. In other parts of the province, we have farmers being or producers being impacted by wildfires, and those wildfires are impacting rangelands and the ranchers trying to produce cattle in those regions. But also, some of the wine producers. We are just now getting a grasp of what the impact of smoke is on crop production more broadly. So, yeah, the impacts are variable, and we're just starting to get a handle on what they mean.
That's a wide range of effects that's happening. And, of course, climate change is probably the biggest factor that people think of when this happens. And, this, at least in my research, I can see that this is a direct result of it. Where do you see climate change going and the effects in the future or in the immediate present? What effects does it have on, say, a food consumer?
The food that people are wanting to buy. I mean, the reality is that much of our food in Canada comes from somewhere else. We were an amazing producer of food, but a lot of that is for export. Yeah, when we think about fruits and vegetables, a lot of that is coming from south of the border, and the impacts of climate change in places like California are actually greater than what we're seeing in BC, and expected to be worse. And so it's likely that we're going to see prices go up, but also some things just not being available when we expect them to be available. The plentiful grocery store experience that we've grown to love might not be consistent anymore.
So your work is mainly in mitigation of, you know, climate change and crop yields and things like that. So what methods and maybe new techniques are being used now to kind of accommodate this, or are being developed for maybe accommodation in the future?
Yeah. So when we say mitigation, I'm specifically focused on reducing the emissions coming from agriculture and utilizing agriculture to sequester carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in agricultural soils. I also focus on adaptation, so helping producers develop strategies to better deal with the changes that we're now seeing. So in terms of the mitigation aspects, we're focused on really trying to understand which practices are most likely to minimize the emissions that we're seeing. So right now, Canadian agriculture represents 10% of the national portfolio of greenhouse gas emissions. So I was just going to say, agriculture represents a sizable portion of emissions nationally and internationally, and we really need to immediately turn off the tap. Like we've got to stop putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere as soon as possible, and that means all sectors have to participate. And right now, the expectations of agriculture are fairly low, if non-existent, because the reality is farmers are already facing so many challenges, and we have to have food. So the trick is how do we develop strategies that won't further impact farmers' ability to produce food, but also gives us the possibility to actually meet our emission reduction targets, which are extremely ambitious at this point. So, you know, by 2030, we're trying to get emissions, you know, depending on what jurisdiction you're in, we're trying to get emissions somewhere around 45% below previous levels of, you know, depending on where you are, 2005, 2007 levels of emissions. And then by 2050, we're aiming to have net zero emissions. So, you know, as other sectors start to meet their emission reduction targets, agriculture is going to become a big culprit in the emission profile. So we've got to start working on strategies that reduce those emissions while also building the resiliency of the sector. Agriculture is already hard hit. It's going to be the hardest hit, likely, as the climate becomes more volatile. So, you know, one of the focus areas that I think will help meet emission reduction targets and also help build resiliency is focusing on soil health. Trying to help producers identify ways to improve soil health, pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, while also building the capacity of their farming system to continue to operate in these volatile conditions.
It's interesting that you mentioned reductions specifically in agriculture to help, you know, tackle this problem. I was speaking with a couple farmers, and one of the techniques that they brought up was rotational grazing. For a quick summary, it's essentially allowing a herd to graze in an area until they're done and then move on to the next one and rotate. One of the comments they made was that, you know, this was a technique used by herd animals before Canada's settler history. So techniques like that, is that enough? Is there more that needs to be done? And is this a practice that's even widely adopted in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very promising practice. The issue is whether or not it encourages having more animals on the landscape. I mean, the reality is that the majority of emissions coming from agriculture are coming from enteric fermentation from ruminant animals like cows. So while rotational grazing might do a great job in reducing those emissions by sequestering carbon in soil and maybe even reducing the emissions coming from the animals, it's not clear whether that's going to be enough to meet our emission targets, or even the demand for meat. So, you know, one of the reasons that we do have intensive animal production is to provide meat products to consumers who have a high demand for that and, you know, don't want to pay high prices.
So that's an interesting point. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we can implement to maybe change the industry, but the societal attitude is something that's kind of a broader point. So just on that note, do you see government policies effectively tackling this right now? Are they helping these new techniques to be implemented? What are you seeing on that front from a policy standpoint?
I mean, the government is trying to do something. I want to encourage them to continue to develop policies that will address this problem. It is not enough, and it's not going to be rapid enough. So the amount of dollars that's going to address this situation is embarrassing. We are facing a climate emergency, and we're pretending like it's something that's for the next generation to deal with. No one grasps the fact that if we don't deal with it now, the next generation can't deal with it. So our policymakers are in a really precarious situation where they are trying to deal with something that the voters don't completely understand and aren't impacted by. And the constituents are a generation away.
I've had this conversation with a couple of other people about this subject, and it's hard not to sound alarmist when, you know, looking at the current climate crisis and how it's impacting the agricultural situation. But this urgency keeps coming up. Do you feel that it's, you know, we're going to hit these targets? Do you think that there will be public pressure enough to do so? Do you think that maybe there's possibly labor action that farmers can take? I just want to get your approach to this situation.
So the current trajectory indicates we will not meet the targets. We will not address the infrastructure needs and the needs of the farmers to adapt quickly enough. And you're right, it sounds alarmist, but if it's an emergency, if the house is on fire and you're not getting the fire department there, you gotta sound alarmist, right? And you know, as a scientist, I feel like that's my responsibility. We have been sounding the alarm since the 80s, and no one has been acting.
I kind of want to bring this a little bit closer to home. Like you said, a lot of constituents aren't at least immediately affected, or affected in a way that is a one-to-one. Like, prices may go up, but with a lot of other factors, prices at the grocery store have been going up. My question is, at what point is Canada's food supply directly affected? It doesn't sound like it's going to happen anytime soon where there won't be food available, but this seems like a real concern with the trajectory I've seen.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on what kind of food you're talking about. So, you know, we are a major exporter of grains, pulses. I don't see that our food security in that area is at stake, but what's at stake is global food security, that the reliance on our canola, on our pulses, like that has real impacts for other parts of the world. In terms of other commodities, our reliance on fruits and vegetables, that certainly is at stake at this point. You know, we import a sizable amount of fruits and vegetables into Canada, and we're not doing a great job of developing local food systems. And even for the local production, we're not developing the strategies quick enough to help them adapt the infrastructure required for that adaptation.
So I just want to get a little clarification on this. It sounds like Canada does have the capacity, if needed, to foster local food production to kind of compensate, but where we're at now doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, right now we're used to eating lettuce year round. We're bringing in lettuce from California Central Valley and Salinas Valley during the winter, and places in Mexico. We could be using our croplands to produce vegetables other than salad and freeze them for the winter time. We don't have to have year-round fresh fruits and vegetables to meet our dietary needs. If we were to build capacity in terms of processing of those vegetable products, we certainly could be much more food self-sufficient across the country. But the reality is we have a harsh winter. We can't, you know, there's lots of work being done right now on indoor production. I think that will put a dent in some areas. Maybe we'll be able to grow our lettuce indoors. But for the vast majority of our demands, I think that's, it's going to be a long time before that's a possibility. And I think, you know, there's some serious energy constraints that go along with that. Absolutely, we can't be pumping more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere to make that happen.
All right, so it's been a lot of, alarmist, but quite frankly, sobering analysis here. I kind of want to know, is there reason to be hopeful? What positives are happening right now?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I use BC as the canary in the coal mine example of, you know, all these are all the things that are that we've been talking about will happen from climate change are now happening in BC, but also BC is a great example of mobilization. So there's been an organization in BC driven by producers called the Climate and Agriculture Initiative. It's now transformed, been taken over by the BC Ministry of Agriculture. It really has done a great job of doing regional impact assessments on climate change and engaging with stakeholders to better understand what the challenges are likely to be and what their priorities are, and then mobilizing some action in those regions that are regionally specific and commodity specific, which is exactly what's needed. So I think we are a great example of that. We also have the BC Agricultural Climate Action Research Network, so a group of scientists across the province working at government and university institutions, working together to try to address some of the research needs of the agricultural producers. So there's some action being taken, and I am certainly hopeful that we can mobilize. We can tackle some of these challenges. A lot of it is not rocket science. When we're talking about irrigation infrastructure, we don't need fancy sensors to tell us that the crops need water if we don't have access to water. So we know how to build irrigation infrastructure. We just got to put the money and the people power towards it. And that comes back to, you know, what we were talking about earlier in terms of the challenges for policymakers. You're building irrigation infrastructure for 10 to 30 years down the road. And, you know, that's a pretty tough sell for a policymaker to make to constituents today who are facing all sorts of financial constraints.
So it sounds like there is hope if you know, pressure comes and the right moves are made.
Absolutely. We can, I mean, that's the most frustrating thing about this. Like we can tackle this problem. It's just, we've got to put our effort into it.
That was was Scott Martin in conversation with Sean Smuckler, Associate Professor in Applied Biology and Soil Science at University of British Columbia and Director of the Center for Sustainable Food Systems at UBC Farm. Thanks so much for that, Scott and Sean. Switching gears now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from the week on Rabble.ca. Let's jump right in. This week in world news, Dr. Yipeng Gui shared his experiences on the Gaza Freedom Flotilla ship, Handala. Dr. Gui is an Ottawa-based family physician and human rights activist. Dr. Gui spent more than a week on the ship, Handala, as it made its way towards Gaza from Italy. He left Handala before it began the final leg of its journey on July 20th. The crew of the Handala hopes to break Israel's blockade of Gaza. For months, Palestinians in Gaza have faced famine conditions as Israel has tightly controlled all food, water, and medical aid from entering the territory. Meanwhile, hundreds of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli soldiers as they tried to get aid from the Israel and U.S.-run Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. Dr. Ji explained that the efforts of those on board the Handala give him hope in the face of the horrors coming out of Gaza, saying, quote, "Having met and befriended the incredible people both in front of and behind the scenes has me hopeful in the face of bearing witness to the unimaginable suffering in Gaza as a consequence of Zionist settler colonialism and the ongoing Nakba. There are 21 beautiful humans on board the Handala Freedom Flotilla sailing to Gaza right now. They are supported by hundreds and thousands of people who have organized tirelessly to make this possible. There are more boats being planned because if the illegal Israeli siege and blockade on Gaza Strip remains, there will be people who will challenge it to see the day that Palestine is free." End quote. Also, in other news related to the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the latest review in Rabble's Book Lounge covers the history of the conflict in the Middle East and how to respond to the Zionist government in Israel and their supporters. Published this past April, Genocide Bad by Sim Kern not only outlines the current genocide in Gaza being perpetrated by the Israeli military, but also gives advice on how to respond to those who defend the slaughter. Kern responds to 9 main contentions of the apologists, ranging from, "Who are you to speak on Israel?" to, "But the Holocaust?" to, "But Hamas?" to, "The old chestnut, criticizing Israel is anti-Semitic." Tom Sanborn, who reviewed Genocide Bad for Rabble, writes, quote, "Think of this remarkable and important book as an introduction to the problem of white settler colonialism on Palestinian land, and as a point-by-point refutation of the main claims of Zionists," end quote. In labor news this week, members of the Canadian Union of Postal Workers began voting on the latest offer from Canada Post. The union was ordered by the federal government to allow their members to vote on this offer, despite union negotiators saying that it does not meet their needs. Canada Post's offer falls short of the union's demands in terms of pay increases. As well, Canada Post's offer includes introducing part-time positions, something that the union opposes. Included in the offer would be a $1,000 signing bonus for full-time employees and a $500 signing bonus for all other workers. The Canadian Union of Postal Workers recommended that their members vote against the deal. Canadian Labour Congress President Bea Brusk slammed the federal government for forcing the vote, saying, quote, "Rather than supporting fair, good-faith bargaining between parties, the government continues the troubling union-busting trend we've seen from both Liberal and Conservative governments. When the government signals to employers that they can drag out negotiations and then be rewarded with a legislative shortcut, it undermines the foundation of fair and meaningful bargaining." End quote. Staying with labor news, the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions is calling on all provinces and territories to abide by a minimum nurse-to-patient ratio. So far, only 2 provinces have made progress towards establishing a minimum nurse-to-patient ratio. BC passed a law in 2024 requiring a minimum of 1 nurse for every 4 patients. Nova Scotia also passed a law in 2024 requiring a minimum nurse-to-patient ratio, but has not yet set out what that ratio should be. All areas of nursing, from emergency rooms to doctor's offices, require more nurses to meet their needs. But a study from the Canadian Institute for Health showed that the number of nurses in Canada actually rose in 2022. The federal government and many of their provincial and territorial counterparts have introduced programs in recent years to recruit nurses, either domestically or from other countries. In a press release to the media, the Canadian Federation of Nurses Unions says that not only do there need to be minimum nurse-to-patient ratios, but also safe and sustainable working environments for nurses. The Federation's press release reads, quote, "When 2 in 3 nurses report that their workplaces are regularly over capacity, we know healthcare planning has gone wrong. We know that near-miss errors are a danger to patients. We cannot continue to accept unsafe healthcare working conditions as the norm, especially when there are known concrete evidence-backed solutions that would turn the tide on this crisis and improve our public healthcare system for both workers and patients." End quote. Also this week, Rabble publisher Sarah Sahagian deconstructs the tradwife trend and compares them to the less talked about everything wives. The tradwife has become a social media trend in conservative circles, where women are celebrated for marrying young and becoming stay-at-home moms who do all of the housework and often even homeschool the children. Sahagian compares this to the everything wife, who are women who do all the tradwife does and still hold down a full-time job. According to Sahagian, the tradwife is a call back to an earlier age before the rise of feminism in the 20th century. The everything wife is not a feminist answer to the tradwife, but yet a further example of the unequal relationship between men and women. In world news this week, Georgia Kelly, communications director for Canada-China Focus, in an op-ed on Rabble, asks why Canada is continuing to participate in war training exercises with the U.S. This month, Canada, Australia, the U.S., and other countries are participating in the biennial Talisman Sabre War exercises in the South Pacific. Kelly explains that these exercises seem to be aimed at one country, China, and puts Canada on a path to a conflict that can be avoided. At a time where tensions with the U.S. are heightened, Kelly questions why Canada continues to allow its foreign policy to be dictated from Washington. These war games are fantastically expensive and harmful to the environment. Rather than raising hostilities with China, Canada should instead focus on real existential threats like climate change. And finally, in Alberta politics, Premier Daniel Smith was outraged this week after a report published by the town of Jasper, Alberta, said that provincial officials were more of a hindrance than a help in their response to the wildfire that ravaged the town last summer. The report does not assign any blame, but does state that the province's involvement created delays and confusion. The report reads, quote, "Provincial involvement added complexity to the response as the province of Alberta, though not jurisdictionally responsible to lead the incident, regularly requested information and sought to exercise decision-making authority," end quote. Alberta politics reporter David Klamenhage says that it was Smith who decided to get involved with a response to the fire last year because she saw an opportunity to blame the federal Liberal government. Klamenhage said that rather than being helpful, Smith saw a chance to gain political points in the face of a crisis that destroyed people's homes and businesses. To read the full version of all the stories that we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in.